Breaking news coming in from Bet365, and it's no surprise. Same game parlay from Bet365 just keeps getting better.
Well, it's even easier to make a bet. Choose from the most popular markets, like hits, run line, totals, and home runs. So many to choose from.
Download the app, start building your bet, and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply.
Welcome to the Edge of Sports podcast. I'm Dave Zirin. We have a heck of a show this week. And first and foremost, thank you to The Nation Magazine for sponsoring this podcast. Later on in the show, we're going to hear, and you know this guy, teacher, activist, educational, justice, impresario, author of the new book, Teach Truth. His name is Jesse Hagopian. We're not having Jesse on to talk about education policy. What we have him on for is that he just managed one of those, the most incredible Little League seasons I've ever heard about. It's political, it's beautiful, it's everything we love about sports. And I'm really looking forward to getting Jesse on later on so we could talk all about it. But first, we got an issue that we really need to discuss. You know, we discuss stadium issues on this show, and this is one right in my backyard, and it's one that has ramifications throughout the world of sports. And I'm talking, of course, about the Washington football team and their effort to get a largely publicly funded stadium out of the suburbs of Maryland and back into Washington, D.C. And I got someone to speak with who can really break down for us why this is a bad deal. He's the senior research fellow with the Sports Fans Coalition. He was brought on as a fellow specifically to dig into the history of publicly funded sports stadiums, and he's really turned up a cornucopia of issues to share. His name is Evan Brown. How you doing, Evan?
I'm doing good, Dave. Thanks for having me on.
Absolutely. So for almost 30 years, DC and DC area football fans have been pining for the team to come back from the district and out of the Maryland suburbs. And yet your research leads you to believe that this is a bad deal for the people of DC and one they should reject, even with all the feelings they have about putting the team back where they feel it belongs. Why is this a bad deal?
Well, I'm glad you mentioned those feelings because that's part of the whole process. The interesting thing about this is that it doesn't even take that much, honestly, of my research, because there's been so much over the last decades from economists, from journalists, from historians that has made it clear across the board that the pattern of these deals is good for teams, good for billionaire owners, bad for cities. And so then when we come to this specific deal, as you say, this big announcement and everybody perhaps is excited, right? The team coming back to DC. And as you know, I mean, you of all people would know about this, having writing about the World Cup, writing about the Olympics, other guests you've had on the show, that excitement is the opportunity for these teams to just rush through all the questions that researchers examine and just get the stadium underway. Mm. And so the intervention of research here in this moment is to take a step back, to take a pause and say, what is DC actually going to get out of this deal? What is the team going to get out of this deal? And it'll be no surprise to your listeners that it is at the moment a very, very lopsided proposal.
Well, tell us what makes it a lopsided proposal. And do you believe that that when it comes to publicly funded stadium deals or partially publicly funded or however you want to put it, that there are greater or lesser evils of these deals? Can they be assuaged? Can they be made better for a community? Or do you think that there's an inherence to when you're going to have this multi-billion dollar project that doesn't really have use value 365 games a year, that it's just not the best use of public funds?
Yeah, so the public funds involved in this case are especially enormous. We're looking at $1.1 billion. And that's, I should say too, that's the number that they're willing to put in the headline, right? There's obviously lots of other hidden costs and things that only become apparent over the years. But $1.1 billion for a stadium for one team. And an NFL team at that. And when you ask if there's greater or lesser evils, one thing I'll mention right away is that NFL stadiums generally are the least useful because of how few times a year their tenants actually operate. You know, as a historian, it's not my place to prognosticate about, you know, whether the Commanders will make the playoffs, putting it to, you know, 10, 11 games rather than 8 or 9. But regardless, it's not a promising from the outset when you're looking at an NFL stadium. The other piece of context here to think about is that the relationship of this size of money, both to sort of DC's current budget and the current situation with public funds, social services, all of the other urgent political issues facing the city. And secondly, the relationship to the already very generous public funding for stadiums that DC has been trying really ever since the Washington football team left back in 96. So if you go through from 1996 to the present and you look at what was used to be the MCI Center is now Capital One Arena, you look at Audi Field, you look at the Nationals ballpark, you look at this smaller arena where the Mystic play. The public funding put into each of those, when you adjust for inflation, comes out to around $2.15 billion. And again, this is just sort of these headline totals, not calculating in sort of the kind of hidden costs that accumulate over time. So what we're talking about when we look at this Commander Stadium proposal is one subsidy that is half of the entire already extensive amount that DC has spent on all teams across all sports in the almost 30 years since the NFL left Washington in the first place.
Now, I want to just first and foremost like get people just a couple of checkpoints on this, bullet points, if you will. So the problem with the deal is the 1.1 billion. It's beyond what the city can afford, especially in an era of profound budget contraction from the federal government, as well as threats of governmental takeovers. Other than the 1.1 billion, what else is noxious about this plan?
Well, when you look at the term sheets for these sort of stadium arrangements, there's lots of convoluted bits and pieces that add up to essentially revenue streams for the NFL or other sports team that is going to be the tenant. So in this case, for instance, when you even though the stadium, right, is, you know, public ownership, the lease turns it over to the team to operate, right, to bring in the revenues for the sales tax from those revenues to go back into the stadium rather than into the city. And it does all this for essentially no rent. In the proposed term sheet, the rent was put at a dollar, right? A nominal amount. Just there's all sorts of individual line items in the term sheet that are tweaked and fine-tuned by the team to extract maximum revenue from this public subsidy. And this is something that NFL teams and other sports teams are experts at, right? They have a playbook, they run it over and over. They come to these cities where, you know, legislators, politicians, city council members, they have lots of other issues to worry about. And they obviously want to be associated with, you know, a flashy new stadium, possibly a successful team, right? And so they don't always have the opportunity to dig down into each of these individual items that have been so carefully structured by team ownership. And so part of the equation is just taking the time to say, hold up, stop. We should have hearings. We should have independent analyses. We can't just believe what the team tells us, what the consultant tells us. But the other piece that's really interesting is that each of these terms is actually an opportunity for the city, for the public, for the fans to get something out of the stadium project, right? If this extensive public investment is going to happen, every single line of that deal is a chance for somebody to say, hey, wait a second, this could be more public, more accessible, it could benefit the community more. And, you know, putting forward an actual negotiation, right, rather than a capitulation, mm-hmm. is how to, back to your question of lesser and greater evils, right, how to start swinging the pendulum away from handouts and more towards something resembling a partnership.
So what kind of federal oversight is there over this deal? I mean, Donald Trump made news the other day, both in sort of saying casually that a federal takeover of DC was probably an inevitability, you know, the way he always does, like, hey, I'm going to thought balloon authoritarianism and see how badly people respond to it. So, and then I'll adjust accordingly. So he throws out a little thought balloon about federal takeover of the city being an inevitability. And he even threw out a line about my chief of staff, Susie Wiles, has a great relationship with the mayor. So this is going smoothly, talking about Mayor Bowser. Are there, you know, we all know about how Trump tries to use sports. The NFL draft is coming to D.C. next year, which is, I think is frankly just going to be disgusting. And I like the NFL draft. But I think in this setting under this president, it's going to be just disgusting. So what do we, is this is really a city decision or is the federal government pulling the strings on this?
So this is interesting because I think there's both the specific situation with this piece of land, which was originally federally controlled and then transferred into city control as part of the process around this stadium deal. But what's underlying your question seems to me is a real both worry, but also opportunity that reflects how stadiums are always these sort of public and political spaces that are going to be contested. And as I invoke this, I really need to highlight an excellent recent book called The Stadium by Frank Garrity that gives the big history of these sites and how there's no avoiding political confrontation. There's no avoiding, right? If a space is public, there are going to be clashes over how it's used, over who gets to say how it's used. And I think it's not huge reason for optimism that anything the Trump administration is going to do would be good for the city. But the broader concept of taking the venue from a space where the NFL is calling the shots, where the owners of the teams are calling the shots, and moving it into a political and public arena opens up possibilities that, you know, we'll have to fight over, right? It's not going to be pretty all the time, but can lead to outcomes that are desirable. Something relevant when you ask about federal power and you ask about the RFK Stadium site. Mm. If we go back to 1961, when RFK Stadium first opened, and back then, the Washington football team had flat out refused to desegregate, but they were moving into this stadium that was on federal land. And because of that, the Kennedy administration and the Department of the Interior were able to go to the team and apply pressure that led to the hiring of black players. So there is a way that putting accountability, putting democratic processes, even at a time like this where they feel so fragile and so contested, putting them into the stadium equation can actually leave a legacy beyond sort of profits for team owners and a sort of empty concrete shell.
So I wanted you to go again, like, about the bill. Do you expect it to pass? I know you were giving or are giving testimony with this to that effect. Do you think the testimony will make an impact? Is like, what's the state of the vote? What's the state of resistance to this vote? And what are some ways that you would suggest the vote, I mean, the bill change so it provides as some harm reduction to such a project if it does pass?
So one important thing has already happened, which is that as I was describing, the initial play for the stadium proposal was to wrap it all up in the excitement of the announcement, to put it in the budget, and for it to pass with the budget. And City Council has taken a very important step of removing it from the budget to study it independently, to say this is a big expenditure, it's a complicated, important issue, and we need to slow down, we need to study it, and we need to get the voices of DC residents involved in the process. And this is really key. Sometimes this doesn't happen, right? This is a positive development in the stadium process. And as I'm sure you and many of your listeners know, when you ask people whether they want a stadium, you know, dropped down on them, they have mixed feelings. People get excited, right, about the team. They get excited about, you know, going to a game, but they also might feel, well, actually, they're not going to get to go to a game because it's too expensive, or that, you know, the neighborhood's going to change in ways they don't like. And so what's happening right now is that many different community groups, organizations, sort of individuals with an interest in the situation are looking at the deal and they're saying, where can we find leverage for changes that we want to make in the city with the city's money, right, that's going towards this NFL team? So that could be, you know, that could be something like housing, that could be something like tax policy, that could be even just where the parking lots are located, right? There's so many different directions, and the hearings are going to give an opportunity for people to come at it from different angles. So as far as the work of the Sports Fan Coalition, there are issues very related to kind of fan experience that are both specific to the problems of this project in DC, but also really reflect trends that the NFL and other leagues have been following to extract revenue from fans. So two things, for example, that I would flag that I think are pretty common to fans' experience are these questions of accessibility and affordability, right? So if public funds are going to build a stadium, right, it's not fair at all for the residents who fund that stadium to not have an opportunity to go to a game for economic reasons or for any other reasons, really. So there needs to be some language in the deal that sets up a program that is going to guarantee some sort of access, you know, for working class people who are whose, you know, taxes are going to go towards this stadium. We can't leave them on the outside looking in. And if we're serious at all about this stuff we hear about teams bringing communities together, you know, what kind of stadium is it, right? If only the wealthy, right, the wealthy and their children, right, are able to have that kind of community shared experience of watching the team win or lose. And so inserting that sort of program, right, again, it's one thing to have promises about community support, but there's no reason not to have language in the proposal that commits to some sort of initiative along these lines. A second piece, even if you get in the door, right, concessions have never been more expensive. And if public funds are going to build these concession stands, right, there has to be, again, a way that that support comes with responsibility to the people who are going to be buying these snacks and, you know, maybe a beer or two, right? So I was actually just reading an interesting report by an organization called the Groundwork Collaborative that compares this to airports, right? You know, airports get tons of public funds. They're important infrastructure. But once you go in there as a consumer, you're trapped by a sort of limited array of very expensive, you know, even a bottle of water, right? And so the stadium, you don't want it to just be a big airport, right? People don't love the airport, right? So there should be some sort of, again, fair pricing policy benchmarked to local market rates to prevent the Commanders from gouging fans on concessions that they're buying in a stadium that, again, they built.
Wow. Amen. Wow. Very well put. You've been really generous with your time, and this research is really important. Before you go, I mean, Donald Trump just the other day, I mean, there was some crisis. I believe it was all the horrific dying in Texas. And Nat, one of the pool reporters who have now been carefully manicured for his propaganda purposes, asked him about should the Washington Commanders change their name back to the old racist name. And I don't know if you saw that, but he had a lot to say about it, because I'm sure that's what's on the tip of every American's tongue right now is, will the team name change back? And of course he said, it's weird or terrible, we should change back. And that's all he said. Bowser, Mayor Muriel Bowser, always used to say to Dan Snyder when the team was called its old name, its old racist name, that it would be a non-starter, is what the word she used, to get the team back in D.C. if it didn't change the name first. Those were different times, and Snyder was a particularly noxious person in this area. And I don't think this stadium, you should say if you disagree, I don't think this stadium discussion even happens if Dan Snyder is in the ownership chair. I think that's almost obvious at this point, so you don't even have to respond to that part. But can the name come back? I mean, is this some sort of zombie that will rise from the dead here? I mean, as a way of celebrating bringing the team back to the city.
Well, I think the idea that this is even a question we have to ask ourselves, right, points to kind of the deep problem that we all have about our relationship to the team that is supposedly, you know, part of our community, which is that we don't own it. We don't get to make these decisions. And that is, you know, a lot of the real kind of aggravating, controversial, difficult moments between teams and communities have come about precisely because we can't actually control this thing that matters to us. And I think this is a broader sort of thing people experience in their working lives, in their social lives. And another place that we're hoping to push the conversation that I think addresses this is that stadium negotiations are a moment of leverage that can create different types of relationships between a team and a community. Mm-hmm. And in particular, a community that is going to invest $1 billion in a team, that should be treated as an investment. And if you invest in something, you get a stake, you get equity, and you get a voice. And so I think a bigger picture way of responding to this concern about the naming is to say, wait a second, if we're giving all this money to the team, the public should have a real meaningful say in how it operates in Washington. And so for that reason, another idea that is coming out of this contestation of the proposal is to promote accountability and model a new kind of partnership whereby for the $1 billion+ that DC is going to put into the team, the community should have a say, voting rights, a stake in all the decisions that the team is going to make moving forward.
Mm. Evan Brown, man, the work with Sports Fans Coalition has been fantastic. The work the organization has done is utterly indispensable. Thank you so much for joining us here. How can people find out more about the campaign? How can people find out more about Sports Fans Coalition?
Well, all the usual online venues, sportsfans.org, and just keep an eye on what's happening. If you're in DC, keep an eye on city council. And if you're in some other city, you know, it's a lot of these decisions get made at a local political level where, you know, things happen quickly. People have a lot going on. And the next thing you know, the deal's done and there's no revisiting it until 20 years later when the team threatens to move.
Boy, is that the truth. Evan Brown, Senior Research Fellow with Sports Fans Coalition. Yo, man, thank you so much for joining us here on the Edge of Sports podcast.
Thank you, Dave. A pleasure.
Awesome. We'll be back right after this, after a short word from the sponsor of this podcast, The Nation Magazine. We'll be back right after this with a quick word from Edge of Sports. Hey, everybody out there. This is Dave Zirin with the Edge of Sports podcast. People got to know that we put this podcast on with elbow grease and bubble gum on a weekly basis. And we're proud of the work that we do. We love it, but we can't do it without support from you, the listener. So please go to patreon.com/edgeofsportspod and support the podcast. That's patreon.com/edgeofsportspod. Any little bit you might give to support the podcast actually makes a huge difference to the work we're trying to do. That's patreon.com/edgeofsportspod. We appreciate you. Make no mistake about it. And now, back to the Edge of Sports podcast. We are back on the Edge of Sports podcast. If you are a longtime listener to our program, I think you're going to remember this guest from months and years past. He is a leading education activist in these here United States. And his most recent book is called Teach Truth: The Struggle for Anti-Racist Education. Now, we could talk to this individual about his book, his activism, till the cows come home. But this is a sports and politics show. And this individual just had an experience as a youth baseball manager that I felt belonged on the Edge of Sports. It is a sports story that I want you to hear, even if none of the players are named Shohei Ohtani. Because frankly, that's what the sports world is all about. It's about the stories and adventures of people you haven't heard of. That's where all the good gold lies. And so I want to bring him on now to speak. I haven't said his name yet because I want it to be the mic drop, because I know how many of y'all love his work. His name is Jesse Hagopian. Jesse, how are you, sir?
Hey, Dave. Thanks for having me back on the show.
Absolutely, man. So you heard my intro. You're a baseball manager, you coach the youth, and you just had a really, really incredible run that's infused with everything we love about sports, and particularly everything we love about politics when it can be refracted through sports as a way to bring people together. So please, by all means, the floor is yours.
Oh, thank you, Dave. Yeah, I would go so far as to label the season that I just coached in the majors division of Little League here in Seattle as the greatest Little League season that ever happened. And let
me, in the city of Seattle.
In the city of Seattle for sure, but maybe in all-time history.
All-time.
All-time. And let me make my case. Let me make my case today.
Wow, bad news Bears. Watch out.
Exactly. Exactly. And we had a lot better racial politics on our team than the Bad News Bears as well.
Yeah, Tanner.
Right?
Yeah.
But it's a really remarkable story. And I appreciate you featuring a Little League story, because I do think some of the most meaningful and lasting moments in sports don't happen at the professional level with people who we don't know and never encounter in our lives. But I think they happen in our neighborhoods with kids and families and community we've built up for many years. And this story really is more than just about wins. It's also about redemption and resistance and joy, all wrapped up in youth baseball. And so I coach a team called the Steelheads, named after the Seattle's Negro League team that happened for 1 year. I believe it was 1946. And I coach in Seattle's historically black and immigrant rich South End of Seattle. And until about 15 years ago, Rainier District Little League was a majority players of color league, black and Asian, Latina, East African, Pacific Islander, and it was deeply rooted in working class communities. But gentrification really hit hard here, and Seattle is now one of the most unaffordable cities in the country, as housing prices have just skyrocketed and many families of color were pushed outside of the Seattle city limits. And so the league began to shift to a majority white demographic. And RDLL is really a microcosm. Rainier District Little League is a microcosm of what happens across Seattle and urban America, really. I think displacement and shifting power relations in cities, and questions about who gets to lead and who gets to belong in our communities were really raised with this season. And so we started this year with 12 players on our team, but there was another player who had a friend on our team, and his friend was his only way to get to Little League practice and games. And so he asked if he could be the 13th player on our team because he needed his friend to bring him. And it's tough to have 13 players on your baseball team because it means everybody gets less at bats and less playing time. And this player was brand new to the game and had never played. So what that meant was our experienced players get less at bats who are at the top of the lineup. And I knew that that would be the consequence, but I also wanted this brand new player to baseball, this young black kid, to have a chance to play with his friend. And I was excited about the opportunity to mentor him and to help him learn the game for the first time. So, what I didn't know at the time was that he was going to be our lucky number 13 on our team. And, we weren't the most experienced team on paper. We had two players brand new to the game who had never played before on our team, and several others who had just had 1 year of playing. And so we didn't dominate with power hitting and elite pitching. We had a couple of great all-stars on our team returning. My son, who's ambidextrous switch pitcher, really has come a long way with pitching with both hands and just came into his own with throwing strikes this year, which helped us so much.
Now, just so people, because I'm sure people have no experience seeing an ambidextrous pitcher, are you allowed to switch right to left in the middle of an at bat, or do you have to wait for each batter to then switch, or do you have to be one way for an entire inning?
No, so yeah, unfortunately, you cannot switch in the middle of a batter. That would be a very cool advantage that I wish was a rule, because there's so few pitchers that can switch that it seems like if you go to all that trouble to develop the skill to be able to throw with both hands, you should be able to use it more. But once
Also
you
easier on the arm, the more you can switch.
exactly. So once you pitch with one hand to a batter, you have to finish that batter with that hand, but then you can switch for the next batter. The other thing that's frustrating is I wish that he had a different pitch count with each arm, because there are rules about how many pitches you can throw in a game or in a week, that are there for a very good reason, because we need to keep our players safe. And some coaches will wear a pitcher's arm out to the detriment of that player, right? So that we have to have pitch count rules, but if it's there to keep our kids' arms safe, then we should have a pitch count for each arm. But that's a
Well,
whole nother
hey,
beef.
we could have a whole show about ambidextrous pitching. You
That's it.
said you had the greatest little league season in the history of little league. Time to sign that check, Jesse.
Let me back this up. So the incredible nature of this season was not revealed during the regular season. We were 4 wins, 7 losses, and 2 ties. And you wouldn't have known that this was about to become an epic story. But we did something during that regular season that set us up well. I introduced at the first practice an acronym that the student that all of the players internalized, and that was PRIME. And PRIME stood for P, pick each other up. That means if anybody's down, if anybody strikes out, makes an error, it's the whole team's responsibility to come and help pick that person up. R, run everywhere. We're going to take advantage of all the time we have for practice, and we're going to not shuffle and walk to our positions. We're going to hustle everywhere. I, intensity. We're going to play with a lot of focus and purpose and intensity. M, we're going to make mistakes and we're going to grow from them. And this was probably the most important point I emphasized in the season. I want everybody to make mistakes, and you're going to make them. You're going to strike out in key situations that could have won us the game. You're going to make an error that gives away the lead, and that's part of baseball, and embrace it. And the thing that you have to do is learn how to learn from it and flush it and move on. And every time someone made a mistake, I told them they were being a prime player. That was exactly what we talked about doing on this team. And it just took all the pressure off. And then the E to end it was enjoy the game. And that was the other secret to our success, was just emphasizing you're 12 years old, you're 11 years old. Let's go out there and play with joy and just enjoy this incredible time of life. And so, at a
That's great.
game
I
where,
like that one. That's really great. So you instill this. The team is un is suffered some losses during the year, but so what? Because the kids are learning the game and they're picking each other up, and then the playoffs
absolutely.
happen.
Well, right before the playoffs, something absolutely devastating
Oh,
happens.
what
And
happened?
I have to explain this to have people understand how important this season was, because that player, that 13th player we picked up at the beginning of the season, who came to be known as Jackie or Big Game Adu, he came up to me and he said, "Coach, I'm really struggling." He had struck out almost every at bat. He hadn't made contact with the ball and was frustrated. He is a great athlete, but he's new to baseball. And hitting a baseball, as we know, is one of the hardest things to do in sports. And he said, "Coach, would you come to practice early and work with me on hitting?" I said, "Absolutely." So we started getting to practice 45 minutes early and starting on the tee, and then moving to soft toss and then pitching. And after a couple of practices, he started hitting the ball in practice. And that was a huge step forward. But then we had a couple rainouts. This is Seattle. And so he wasn't able to put those new skills into practice. until we finally got a game, and I was so excited after all this work. And first at bat, he comes up and he hits a scorching line drive to the shortstop. And if it was any other shortstop, it would have gotten by him. But this is one of the best shortstops in the league, and he snared it.
It's tough.
Oh, it was heartbreaking that after all that work, the ball got caught, but it was also vindication of the hard work, right? He
Gotcha.
had made a line drive that showed that that work meant something, and we all cheered. The stands erupted for him when he hit that ball. Everyone was so happy. His team was patting him on the back. Next at bat, he gets up and he strikes out. And then his final at bat, he gets up with a runner on first, and I give him the bunt sign. And first pitch, he lays down a beautiful bunt. He moves the runner all the way to third base on the bunt, and they just barely get him at first base. The next hitter drives in the run to tie the game. And the game ends on time because of the time limit, and we end in a tie. But the stands just erupted because his bunt gave us the win. If he had been the last out of the game, that's it, we lose. But he saved the game for us with his bunt. The stands erupt, and his head is down, and he is not looking at me. And I'm wondering what's wrong. Then I call the whole team over for our team huddle. We always do a team huddle after the game right by the fence so all the parents can be part of it, and all of the players give each other what we call spotlights, and they say what they noticed about each other's games, and all the different players gave our player Jackie a spotlight for saving the game with that bunt, and his head is down. And I give him the game ball as the key player that saved the game for us, and his head is still down. And so I pull him aside after the game and I ask him, "What's going on, man? I mean, all that hard work that we put in, and you had your best game of the season, you saved it for us." And he said, "Coach, I got called the N-word. One of the other players on the other team had called him the N-word." And I just started tearing up. And I was trying to hold it together because I was so proud of how hard he worked, so proud of him for putting in the extra effort and then saving the game for us. And then here it is. The thing that he's going to take away is not that hard work can pay off, but that no matter what you do, you're still just seen as an N-word in this society. And that just broke my heart. And I was choking up, having a hard time even talking to him. And, it turned out he had told another adult who was part of the league during the game, and nothing happened. And that was hard too, because I wish the game had just stopped
Yeah, you
right then.
just stop. I mean, we did that in a high school game when I was in high school, and that was not exactly 10 or 20 years ago. That was a minute ago. And we stopped the game when one of my teammates was called the N-word. And my coach took us all off the court and said that other player had to be kicked out of the game or we were just going to leave and forfeit.
See, that's what needed to happen. We can't just continue on as if the score of a little league game is more important than someone's humanity. And
Exactly.
so if I had known during the game, I would have stopped the game immediately and we would have dealt with it. But unfortunately, all the other team had already packed up and gone by the time I knew. And so, I wrote a letter to the league explaining what had happened and saying that things needed to change. We needed a protocol for what to do in game if racial slurs are used, and how to stop the game and address it immediately. And we needed education for our coaches so that they could help our players operate in a multiracial league and build up the kind of community that is needed to play in a multiracial league. And so I asked the league to provide coaches with training, and there's a group called the Center for Healing and Justice in Sports that we researched that said they would agree to work with all of our coaches to help train them in how to build anti-racist teams. And so that was deeply important. And then lo and behold, the first game of the playoffs is against the team with the player that called our player the N-word.
Wow. Tough
So,
time for some action.
yeah, but the problem was we fell behind 3-0. And at that moment, I felt like this was going to be the worst little league season of my life. That after 10 years of coaching in Rainier District Little League, it was going to end with my player working hard, then getting called the N-word, and then us losing in the first round of the playoffs and being out. And that was going to be the end of the story.
Wait. Before you go on, correct me if I'm wrong, but this is also your youngest son's last year of Little League.
That's right.
So it would be the last Little League memory for your boy, and it would be the last Little League memory, I mean, true Little League memory for you. Like, I've coached after my son has graduated, and I still love doing it, but it's different. It just is when you're not coaching your own kid.
Yeah. So this is likely my last season coaching Little League. And the thought of it ending with losing to this team that had put this pain on my player just was heart-wrenching. But my players had a different vision in mind, and they decided that the season wasn't done. And one of my players, nicknamed the Joy Stealer, hit a double.
Great nickname.
My other player, the Diamond Dasher, hit another double back to back, driving him in. And it started off a rally. And then in the bottom of the sixth, the last inning, the Hammer of Rainier hit a walk-off double to score two and send us to the championship game. And my player Jackie, his mom came running out of the stands with a big old smile and a hug for me, and just saying, I was praying for this moment. We couldn't lose this game. My son needed a better lesson. And the eruption of joy, you would have thought we won the World Series after that game. It was so beautiful, but we still had a championship game to play. And, normally I coach the All-Star team as well. And so, even if I was to lose the championship game, I'd still have a run. But this year, I was passed over for that position of coaching the All-Star game. And so, when we fell behind 3 runs again in the championship game, I thought, well, this is going to be the way it ends.
And that's okay.
That's okay.
Doesn't mean it doesn't sting, but that's
Yeah,
okay.
we got to the big game, and if I'm gonna live by the Prime acronym that my players were living by, then it's okay to make mistakes, and we'll pick each other up and move on.
Wow.
But again, my players had a different vision in mind, and an incredible comeback began with one of the most outrageous base running plays, where one of my fastest players thought he had home stolen, dashed home, but then The catcher got the ball in time, so he managed to stop himself an inch before the tag and turn around. He's in a rundown, and then he runs back towards third, and then he races back towards home and just eludes the tag, and that sent off our bench and gave us a boost of energy that brought us back. And then in the final inning, they had the we were up 4-3, and they had the final tying run on third with two outs, and they hit a blast to center field. And that same player, we call him No Fly Zone after the great J-Rod.
Oh, I'm glad it's after the great J-Rod and not the Curb Your Enthusiasm bit about the boxer shorts without the opening in front. Sorry, man. I just had a bad moment with No Fly
Oh
Zone. Go
no,
ahead, go
definitely
ahead.
not that.
Okay.
No, Julio Rodriguez, Dave. Yes, he tracked down the shot to center field and got the last out that won the championship game. And at that moment, my soul was rested. And but you know, just to say the season wasn't done, because the winner of Rainier District Little League goes on to play in the Tournament of Champions to see who's the greatest team in all of South Seattle. And so we had to play all the other leagues. And you know, I said we managed to hang on and win these two incredible comeback games that reminded me of the 1995 Mariners. Where we
Doesn't
always
everything
call
remind you of that?
everything good.
Fair enough.
But I didn't think I wasn't expecting us to make a deep run in the Tournament of Champions, just because with new players who are just learning the game and 13 player roster, it's really hard to go up against seasoned teams.
Definitely.
And so again, the first game, we fall behind 3 runs. That was our MO. And again, because all of the players knew how to pick each other up, nobody panicked. And I really have to say that our conversation with the team before those games, where I told the team about what had happened to Amadou, and I'm sorry, I didn't mean to use his name.
I will edit it out.
Yeah, let's edit it out. When I told the team about what happened to our player who was called the N-word, the team got very serious, and a couple players apologized to him and said, "You told me that this happened, and I didn't think it could have really happened. And I'm so sorry for not believing you. And please know that I have your back."
That's
And so, that was the spirit we brought into the Tournament of Champions. And we won the first game, came back again from that 3-0 deficit. The second game, our player comes to bat, who they've nicknamed Jackie, and we're tied in the last inning, and he hits the only hit of his entire season. He hits the farthest ball anybody on our team hit, shoots it over the outfielders' heads for the game-winning RBI, and sends us to the championship game.
I don't even know what to say about that.
I mean, it was the sweetest vindication I've ever seen. And somehow in the championship game, a team that was 22-2, who had just wrecked every team they played, we were able to stave off, go into extra innings, and the other assistant coach's son, an incredible player that I nicknamed Mr. Dependable, the Rattler, the Bass Dancer, JR, hits a walk-off double to win the game for us and to make us the winner of the Tournament of Champions. There's no better baseball team in Seattle, not only in terms of our record and the score, but in terms of our commitment to justice. And we found out that the league is going to hire the Center for Healing and Justice in Sports. And next year, all the coaches will begin conversations at the beginning of the season about how we build an inclusive, multiracial team so that that never happens again.
Well, Jesse Hagopian, that's one hell of a story. My best to the Steelheads, my
Yes.
best to an incredible season, and thank you for sharing this treasure of a moment in the lives of these young boys, of their families, and certainly for you and your family. Thank you for sharing that with us.
Well, thank you for letting me share this story, and I know it'll mean a lot to all the players. Keep up the great work, Dave.
And you as well, both on and off the field. And for everybody out there listening, thank you, David Tigaboo. Thank you, who's my producer. Thank you so much to The Nation Magazine. Everybody out there, it's a tough world, but we can do it if we come together. We can make this world what we want it to be. Please stay frosty. We are out of here. Peace.